Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. Once again, it is time for Future State Friday. We're going to talk about week four. The first month is done. So we're going to start getting second issues of a lot of these series. And I guess I shouldn't say second issues. I should say final issues because, you know, some of them, like Dark Detective, we're going to cover the second issue. We've already covered the second issue of Next Batman, but you really don't get a sense of did these work. So many of them we've been sort of disappointed in. Come the first week of February, we're going to start seeing some series come to an end. So can the writers, with everything they've been throwing against the wall, can they pull it together for that final issue and see if that happens? But we've got to get through week four first. So there are a couple decent books this time, and there's a couple real stinkers. I kind of want to get the bad one, the one that to me stands head and shoulders above the rest as just a terrible, I just didn't enjoy it. I'm gonna put it that way. I just really didn't enjoy this book.
Can we guess?
I mean, I saw some discourse going on Twitter this week about calling people out for doing bad work. Like when you tweet out or your review and you specifically tag the creator so they get to hear about
Don't tag them.
how terrible it was and how that's kind of bad form. And I agree. There's no reason because I didn't like this that somebody else might not have, you know, somebody else might have enjoyed this very much. I don't know.
You can still say you hated it. Just don't tag the creator.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm reluctant to say that this has no value whatsoever, but man, I really, really did not like this book. So we're going to start there. Anybody want to venture a guess what book it was?
Well, I'm assuming it's the Legion of Superheroes.
Yes, it is the Legion. It is the Legion of Agreed. Superheroes. Written by Brian Michael Bendis. The art is by Riley Rossmo. The colors are by Ivan Placencia, and the letters are by Dave Sharp. Now, I actually talked to Trevor about this before he ever read it, and I think he was already thinking he wasn't going to read it. And then based on what I had said, he was like, he noped right out of it. So he did not subject himself.
Yep. But I leveled up this week, boys.
But I'm assuming the other two of you read it. So we'll give you a chance. But I just want to get it out of the way. So I've gone on record many times as saying I'm not a big fan of Riley Rossmo's style of art. And much like a lot of the other art, it feels even worse than usual this time because it feels rushed. Maybe it's not as big of a step down for me in terms of his art, but I don't know because a lot of times I try to not look at it that closely, to be honest with you. And I just don't care for it's not even his line work, it's his anatomy. It's the exaggeration that he uses in facial expressions and anatomy and such. It's just not my cup of tea. That being said, if I can give a positive to the art, it's that he does have a very unique way of depicting these characters. We've seen all kinds of different designs for the Legion heroes over the years. So it is kind of cool that he's putting his own stamp and giving us some of the, you know, different character designs. I think Bouncing Boy though looks ridiculous. He looks like, a big hefty trash bag. Kind of reminds me of, you guys remember, you may be too young, but the Missy Elliott video from like back in the 90s. Where she's wearing that big, puffy, hefty bag thing.
Dude, I love 90s hip hop. So
you know that video?
You're talking to the right guy.
Do you know that video?
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's what Bouncing Boy looks like. It's ridiculous, but it is cool to see these different designs. And you know, Rossmo, he does have decent transitions and decent storytelling, but I have such a hard time getting past the aesthetic that he uses. So. I just didn't care for it. Now, Bendis, writing the story, I felt like Bendis, and this is a great actual thing for a writer to do where you kind of change the style of your dialogue or the pacing of your dialogue to suit the art. And because the art for Rossmo is kind of so weird and strange, Bendis changing his dialogue and making it kind of weird and not even necessarily choice of word, but just the cadence of it and everything, it suits the weirdness of the art, but I don't care for the weirdness of the art. So I don't care for the weirdness and the pacing of the story either. So it just didn't work for me on any level. I don't think it's a terrible comic in and of itself. But even the whole idea for the first 70 to 80% of the issue, the basically the Legion of Superheroes, which has apparently been disbanded, is coming back together, and they're all working, looking rather for Element Lad. And he seems to be kind of the, I don't know, the ex Deus Machina that's going to save the day and turn back the clock on whatever it is, the threat, which isn't even really presented early on in the story. And then come to find out at the very end, Bendis flips it on us, and it turns out the reason they're all looking for Element Lad is because he's actually the threat. He's actually the bad guy. And normally a plot twist like that would really work for me. But here, I don't know why, it just didn't do it for me. I didn't care for that twist. Maybe it's just I like Element Lad. I don't want to see him turn into a villain. I don't think that's what it is. It didn't work for me. I don't think technically it was done very well. And then you add in the art aesthetic, which I didn't care for, and Bendis' script, which I think was purposely written to try to complement that art aesthetic. It just didn't work for me on any level. The colors are okay, I guess. And like I said, it's interesting to see Rossmo's take on these characters, you know, future versions of their costumes. So it's not completely, you know, everything positive, worst comic I've ever read kind of thing, but it was pretty rough. It definitely was the one that I liked the least, and I would never read it again if I could avoid it. And I don't know if I'll read issue two. It's going to depend on my mood when the comic is put in front of me. So what did you think, Nick?
Well, I realized something just about all of Future State. Basically, all the two-part issues, they all feel like, when you compare them to the movie, that the first issue is setting up everything, and the second issue is going to be like the third act. Like, the first issues feel crunched, so I'm hoping the second issues just pay off all this. Like, they've all, even like Harley Quinn, it feels like it just built up to what's going to be the next issue, which is Black Mask. Like, that one rushed you through a bunch. So this felt like this too, and as someone who has only read the Legions of Superheroes when they pop up in other books, it just didn't make any sense at all to me. I don't know any of these characters, so that's just me being someone who's new to that group. I didn't understand it at all. That's on me, not on them. But just going back to the pacing of it, book versus movie, it felt like a very bad team-up movie that's like, here's 100 characters, and they each get one like feature of... they all just get one feature that defines them in this because you don't know them. So, yeah. And there, I'm looking at a 9-panel page right here. And there's not a dark side is anywhere on it. So I'm just disappointed.
Fair enough. What about you, Rocky? What did you think?
I actually did a very detailed review of this for the Weird Science DC website. I've already viewed it on my channel. I will say this, that I think it's unfortunate that, at least from an artistic standpoint, Ryan Sook's pencils and art has been really good on the Legion of Superheroes main series, notwithstanding the fact that it's not particularly not a well-constructed story by Bendis in the first 12 issues of the Legion of Superheroes. I think visually, artistically, Ryan Sook, along with a couple of other guest artists, have done a reasonably good job of conveying a very, very interesting and visually enticing future, at least from a visual perspective. And so I find it very odd that the Future State is probably getting more publicity than most titles, because there's some hype surrounding Future State. So for them to put Riley Rossmo on this title, I thought was a very curious choice and a very, I think, divisive choice. I applaud you for your diplomacy, Chase, on Riley Rossmo. I also exercise diplomacy in my review. I do think I'll give him some credit. He did a couple of Vertigo series. I thought he did a Martian Manhunter series that I thought his art was more... It is an artistic style that you can get accustomed to. And I actually do think that it works for some stories, less so for this one. It was a miss for me, that although I have to say that I'm not going to focus on Rossmo. I'm going to focus on Bendis, because this story is something that could have been far more enticing than it was. I do believe that one can get around Rossmo's art, because I do think I think you can still figure out what the story is, because you know, frankly, what's the excuse for the story being bad? Because some of the art is covered up by a pile of dialogue by Bendis, which doesn't really advance the narrative particularly well. This is completely disconnected from the narrative in the mainstream Legion of Superhero universe. We have no teasing of a Great Darkness saga. There's no Superboy. There's no Monel. There's no General Zod. Rogelzar was dispensed with in the last issue. Element Lad were people crying out for Element Lad to being a major villain in the Legion of Superhero universe? I mean, where did that come from? I don't know. The whole thing was generally it's a miss for me. It's a miss for me. And just to be polite about it, I'll just stop talking about it, and I'll just say that it was definitely the most disappointing of week four of Future State for me.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm glad you brought up Martian Manhunter. So, you know, as much as I don't care for Rosmo's art, I loved that story. I read all 12 issues multiple times. You know, I read each issue of that as it came out, and then read it all in one sitting. And it did work. And a lot of it was because it was Martian Manhunter, and it was shape changing, and it was a great story by Steve Orlando. So yeah, with the right story and the right tone, Rosmo's art can work. And I agree with you. I don't even necessarily blame Rosmo. He was the wrong choice. That's an editorial failure, in my opinion. The future, usually you think of the future as bright and, you know, a lot of technology, and it's a lot of sharp edges. And you bring in this guy who is super stylized. Yeah, big, big, big miss. Unless you're going to go completely out there on alien planets with, you know, globs, basically, which is sort of what the Martians are, then Rosmo's the wrong choice. All right, well, let's move on to bigger and better days. I'm not sure where we're going to land on this one, but I kind of liked it. So I want to talk about Batman, Superman next. Let me give the creative team. It's written by Gene Luen Yang. The art is by Ben Oliver. Colors by Arif Prianto and letters by Tom Napolitano. So let's give you a chance, Trevor. What'd you think of Batman versus Superman?
Am I muted? No, I'm not muted, right?
No, we can hear you.
We can hear you.
Okay, good. I tried to like make sure you didn't pick up like my ambient while everybody else was talking. So yeah, Batman Superman was just kind of continuing the streak of meh from Future State. Ben Oliver, you know, I'll get into his art a little bit. I think he's normally a pretty tremendous comic book artist, and he's done some really great cover work. But this certainly was nowhere near his best, as most of Future State has been for even top tier artists. The design work in and of itself is beautiful, but it lacks energy. It feels very rigid and flat. And sort of as a result of that, all of the gestural work and emotiveness of the characters suffers from the lack of articulation in the figure designs. And regarding like the shortcomings, he used silhouetted shots 15 times in this book. I counted 15 times, which can be a very, very powerful visual tool in a comic book. But when you overuse it, it very much comes off as lazy and tells me that he didn't have enough time on this book and that he defaulted to literally blacking out figures. And again, I think it was like the first time it shows up when they have Batman wrangling up one of the sort of vermin gang. It looks cool. It's visually sharp. Then the other 14 times it proceeded to happen, I actually started getting annoyed by it. So, you know, I get the sense that it was very much out of laziness and or a time crunch, which is unfortunate because Ben Oliver is a great artist. And sort of despite those shortcomings, I thought what he was doing with camera was pretty good. It was effectively placed in the scene for shot size and angle. And it didn't necessarily make up for sort of how static the characters were, but it was definitely welcome considering, you know, the aforementioned issues with character and the sort of lack of energy. You know, for the millionth time in the last like year or whatever, I'm just getting tired of Superman reminding us that he's revealed his identity. And it feels like this placement of that mention, as many others have been throughout DC these last couple of years, have been without narrative or thematic substance behind it. There's literally no reason, and it makes Superman come off as naive, as he kind of tends to do throughout the issue. It's not just in the sort of constant re-mentioning of his identity being exposed. You know, I just, for him to even make that suggestion to Bruce, especially given like the context of the magistrate, it never makes sense. Like, Superman is certainly not the intellectual that Bruce is, but I think he actually comes off as childishly naive. There, in terms of like the positives of this issue, I like the idea metaphorically of the vermin uprising in Gotham and what that means in this future state, landscape. And I thought the twist at the end was pretty good. Like, although it does take advantage of Superman being a little bit overly naive, it was fine. It was a good way to end the issue on a bit of a cliffhanger. I certainly wouldn't go out of my way to pick up the next issue, and I didn't really buy this one. You know, I read previews, but you know, it's fine. If you want a sort of easy Batman Superman story with low expectations and not be totally disappointed, this one's for you.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. In fact, when we talked about it a little bit spoiler-free on our New Comics Wednesday episode, and my whole thing was, this so clearly happens very early on in Future State as opposed to some of the books that happen later on. It's like, why wasn't this the very first Future State book to come out? You know, we've talked a lot about how it's hard to follow and you're jumping around at different times. And I get that, but that doesn't mean that you, even if you're doing time jumps, that you can't in some way kind of release them or put some kind of, you know, stamp on there that says year, you know, whatever, 2032, you know, and give us some timeline, give us some progression of story, because again, this one happens so clearly early on. So that, I thought that was a missed opportunity. I agree with you on the art. It's clear that Ben Oliver didn't have enough time to do this, just like, you know, we've said so many times. I mean, it literally looks like on some of the panels, he was like, okay, I have this many pages left. I have this many scenes left to do. And it's not like they're silhouetted like he would normally do. Right. Like, it's just blacked. Like, he just went, I don't have time to finish this, you know, tap it with my Apple Pencil or whatever and just black it out. And it pulls you out of the story.
Right. The worst part is, it could be a really effective visual tool when you use it at the right time and when you use it spare. It's an accent, but when you use it 15 times during like a various set of occasions, right? Like, there's no through line. It's not like you're using it for an extreme moment of action. It's not like you're using it for an extreme sort of emotional pinpoint.
Not at all. It's just randomly just thrown in there from time to time. And I wouldn't think that he would even do it this way, because there are other panels where he uses silhouette and it's much more grayscale. It's not just, okay, this is all black. Mm-hmm. And it's not even a black the way he does shadows in other, where there's gradients and, you know, the shadows fade into light and it's not that hard edged line. So yeah, it's clear that he just didn't have time to put detail on some of these things, which is a shame, because it does bring the art down a little bit. I also think he hasn't been doing interiors, sequentials for quite a while. And so there's probably a little bit of rust there as well. You know, he's mostly been doing cover work for the last few years. So I thought the transitions at some point were a little choppy. But I still think overall, when he does get to do his thing, it's clear it's Ben Oliver and the art's great. But yeah, there are some kind of just very apparent failures in the art. And again, I don't necessarily blame Ben himself for that. As far as the story, yeah, again, I think a missed opportunity. It should have been the very first story to be told. I agree with Trevor about, yeah, we get it. Superman revealed his identity. Stop throwing it in our face, because it was a stupid idea in the first place. What the story does get right, what has me very excited about Gene Luang's being the artist on, or the writer rather, on the upcoming Batman Superman when we return to the regularly scheduled programming of DC monthlies. I love the characterization that he gives us in terms of Superman and Batman. The dialogue here is a little kind of hokey, but I'll sort of chalk that up to, again, this isn't the regular timeline. And, you know, he's trying to tell this story of, hey, the magistrate and blah, 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 right? But I think just the way they play off each other, it's clear they care about each other as friends. It does have me excited for let's forget about this whole future state, you know, storyline and plotline, and get back to the regular current DC, where I can see the friendship and the respect and the camaraderie that Clark and Bruce have. And I think Gene's going to really knock that out of the park. So I kind of like this more for what it portends as far as Gene's regular run on the series, as opposed to this particular issue itself. And where the heck the supposed good guy that turns out to be the bad guy here at the end, the twist that Trevor mentioned, where the heck he could have got a kryptonite knife? I don't know. I guess maybe I still live in the John Byrne era where kryptonite, you know, was very, very hard to come by, because toward the end of the Silver Age and into the Bronze Age, anybody could, who was anybody, you could go down to the corner store and buy kryptonite in any number of different colors. And Byrne really walked that back. So I'm still kind of in that mindset that kryptonite is very, very hard to come by. So where the heck this guy got it? I don't know. Lex Luthor, maybe. I guess we'll find out. But I found that to be very surprising, because this is not exactly, you know, a A-level supervillain here. So I guess we'll have to wait for the next issue to find out. What are your thoughts, Rocky?
Well, I won't say too much about the art. I think you guys you give a very detailed and very analytical breakdown of the art. I will say that the use of the shadows in the art didn't bother me too much. I didn't actually, frankly, notice it until you guys brought it to my attention. It didn't take me out of the story. It was actually the fact that there's a shadow on both, on every page, actually seems somewhat consistent to me. So it didn't take me out of the story. Although certainly when having you guys brought it to my attention, clearly there's times when there's a lot of lights in a room, it's a bright room, and then suddenly there's a shadowy figure. There's clearly some inconsistency there. That's probably my lack of readership, because I just started reading comics. That's probably why I never noticed it. I say that tongue in cheek. In any event, that was very astute observation on the art. Story-wise, I love the false face serum as a drug. I thought that was great. I love that story idea. The fact that you can get addicted to a drug, it changes your appearance at a genetic level. But then when you get addicted, it permanently changes and affects your face. I thought that was kind of I just love that as a story idea. And the fact that Superman's going to help Batman get to the bottom of it. And Superman, I love that Superman expressed surprise to Batman, saying, "Batman, I had no idea Gotham had gotten so bad. Why didn't you call earlier?" It's like, well, you know, I've been busy. There's this new guy called the Magistrate. He's causing problems. And I actually thought there was some degree of humor in it as well. And this Mr. Toad, there was even I even felt a sense of some Silver Age absurdity to it, which put a smile on my face. The kryptonite knife out of the blue. I suspect that somehow the magistrate is playing both sides of the equation here, is somehow involved in the drug trade of this false face serum. And I suspect that one of the reasons why the magistrate is, you know, they were planning for, or somebody was planning for Superman eventually showing up. So undoubtedly the same forces that would, soon after the timeline of this murder Bruce Wayne, probably were planning for having to deal with Superman. So the whole kryptonite knife thing is something I can accept. And that's not a huge leap for me. So overall, Gene Luen Yang, again, this is a guy that penned Superman and the Clan. I only read the first issue of that, but I thought that had a very good storyline. Overall, I was entertained by this, but it does have, still has a little bit of a meh factor, as Trevor said.
All right, Nick.
Okay. As someone who hasn't read a comic in a year, and I'm not joking, but like I think I read all the Batman Superman, which ran during the New 52, because my friend used to get that and I'd read all of his comics. So it did feel very much like a normal issue of something, as to what, like the opposite of what I said about most of the issue ones of two-parters, where it felt normally paced for a Batman v Superman or a Batman. God, stop me from saying that. Batman, Superman comic. But yeah, to me, the relationship felt mostly right, which is always the fun. It might as well call it a Clark and Bruce, because you know this is one of the few times it really is them. I mean, they're using their powers, but they're talking as, you know, friends, not like, oh, hey, Batman. Like, so, and yeah, the pace felt like I said, like a normal issue of like a 7-part series or a 2-part series. It wasn't rushed, and yeah, it just felt like a classic Batman and Superman even mystery, where Superman finding something, and then he needs Batman to kind of help. So,
all right. So you're definitely in for issue 2.
Yeah, totally. It's just, yeah, it was just a good comic book. Not great, but it was just, I enjoyed it.
All right. Fair enough. Let's talk about Suicide Squad next. The main story is written by Robbie Thompson, art by Javier Fernandez, colors by Alex Sinclair, letters by Wes Abbott. And then there is a backup Black Adam story, which I kind of enjoyed more than the regular story. The backup story, Black Adam, is written by Jeremy Adams. The pencils are by Fernando Passerin. Inks are by Eau Claire Albert. Colors by Jeremy Cox, and letters by Wes Abbott. So, Rocky, what did you think of Suicide Squad?
I really enjoyed this. This was my second favorite of the week. I know that it's interesting. I know a lot of people, I've sort of just my own little preview online, you know, some people are saying that they thought this was had a difficult time getting through it, and they thought it was maybe a little bit confusing. For some reason, I enjoyed it. I didn't find it all that confusing. I actually enjoyed getting introduced to this Justice Squad of, and eventually would learn it all takes place on Earth 3. To me, all the moving parts of this issue, I could put together as I read it even the first time, which is rare for me because I usually require to read a comic book 2 or 3 times to get all the nuance. But I just love this. Now I do have a bias. I'm a Suicide Squad fan. I love the fact that Amanda Waller, we think she was kidnapped and taken to Earth 3, or they want a Suicide Squad is there to take her back, but she seems to be there with an agenda. Is she our Amanda Waller? Is she the Amanda Waller of Earth 3? We're not sure, but she seems to be in control of the Justice Squad, which previously had taken out the Crime Syndicate. The Crime Syndicate they seem to be dead and in tubes and might be resurrected with a Black Lantern ring. And this is so cool. And then we got deaths in here. We got Sinestro being killed, and we got a different kind of Flash, and we got all these crazy characters. William Cobb is Batman. You know, he ends up getting, who would have thought something horrible would happen to him? Hypnotic Woman, Fisherman in place of Wonder Woman and Aquaman, this Bolt character as the Flash, this new Clayface as Martian Manhunter, and then of course Connor Kent battling between two personalities, between his Connor side, his Kent side versus his Luther side, Amanda Waller wanting him to embrace his Luther side, a dying Brainiac wanting him to pursue and reminding him that he's a Kent and he's still a Superman and you've got that legacy to hold up to, and all this in 22 pages. I was you know, the art wasn't all that great there. You know, there was a scene here artistically where Brainiac is replicating, and I don't think it worked. There was these pink rectangle squares with the word replicate in them, trying to convey the fact that Brainiac was replicating in the battle sequence. And I didn't quite understand what was going on, but I think that's what it was trying to convey, that Brainiac was replicating. So artistically, that didn't really work for me. There were some shortcomings on the art, but I'd be interesting to hear your guys' perspective on that, because I think I've got probably a better eye for artistic appreciation than I do. But overall, it worked for me. It put a smile on my face. And should I comment about the next story, or are we doing this one at a time, Jason?
No, go ahead. Tell us what you think of Black Adam.
I don't know what on earth, why we needed a Black Adam story, but I'm glad we got it. It takes place in the 853rd century, dealing with the Justice Legion. And for those who don't know, the Justice Legion, I think, originated back in 1996, DC 1 million, scripted by Grant Morrison. I actually found it interesting. I'm not really sure how it fits into the timeline. Why do we need a future state story with the Justice Legion? I don't know, but the whole characterization of Black Adam, I, abandoning magic in the future, embracing science and technology, building a new planet of conduct, and making it one of the centerpieces of the universe, and the universe being destroyed by the unkindness, and the Superman Prime, this golden Superman Prime being destroyed, and the universe is going to be destroyed, and this, and the relationship between Black Adam and this, and Wonder Woman, and their Wonder Woman's going to have a child together, and Black Adam finds a reason to live because he's about to give up. And wow, it was just a, it was just an adrenaline rush. This entire issue, both these stories together, one after the other, I got to admit, I really thoroughly enjoyed this. In fact, the more I'm talking about it, I might put it ahead of Aquaman, which we're going to be talking about later, but I enjoyed Aquaman for different reasons, but it just put a smile on my face. And this is definitely at least either my first or my second favorite comic book of this week for Future State.
All right, Nick, what'd you think?
I knew I had one book left to read, and I looked at the list though today. I'm like, no, I read them all. But what I didn't finish was the backup to this. So I haven't read the Black Adam story. I just read the Suicide Squad Justice Squad.
The Black Adam was really good. Anyway, go ahead.
I just forgot. I'm like, I knew I had something left to read, but I don't see a new file. Like, I thought it was Nightwing for some reason. But I know the most interesting part, I don't read a lot of Suicide Squad. I haven't. Most books that I've tried, I probably tried during the New 52 when I was new to stuff. But I think it's a really fun idea. When I opened it, I didn't know who to expect on the team. In fact, the only thing I'd seen about this issue was the last panel. So I'm like, okay, so this is going to be just futuristic Peacemaker and stuff. Because obviously if they're going to do Peacemaker in the movie this year, they're going to make sure he's in the Suicide Squad in some form. But I really like the idea of like an anti-Justice League in a way where they had all the roles or all the archetypes at least filled, Amanda Waller did, rather than like, you know, doing any other sort of team. She's like, I'm going to build something that looks like the Justice League. Definitely love the panel where Batman's head's blown off. Well, this version of Batman, it was the moment I'm like, oh yeah, of course Amanda Waller's involved in an issue with the Suicide Squad, even if it's Future State and their backwards team. But yeah, it was fun to read. Has Peacemaker been in the Suicide Squad recently, or is that because of the movies?
No, he hasn't been in the Suicide Squad since like the late 80s, mid to late 80s, or very early 90s. He hasn't even really shown up in the pages of DC in a really long time.
So
not sure why James Gunn chose him, but yeah, get ready to see a whole hell of a lot of,
because he has a TV show
all the time. Not only is he in the lineup of Suicide Squad, he's getting his own. Is it on
HBO Max?
Or is it on
HBO? It'll be like HBO a Disney Max, Plus show, only DC, like WandaVision.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's why I figured. It's like whenever they're. We've discussed this a lot, Jace, when I've been on different ones with you. Yeah, you see who's going to be in the movie. Suddenly people like even Polka Dot Man are going to show up in the comic.
Yep.
Because I know why the director did it. He wants to introduce the weirdest people that no one would normally touch in the movies. And he wants to use most of them as cannon fodder. But I don't know why the comics have to follow
that.
Which is fine. But I was excited to see Peacemaker now that I know who he is because of the movie.
Yeah, and that's totally fine. I like those obscure characters too. It's fine to put in the movie. I don't know. I'm very skeptical about the TV show. John Cena to me doesn't seem like the caliber of actor to carry a TV show.
He's a funny guy, so it's definitely like a.
I'm not going to watch it. I mean, I'm not going to watch it anyway. So, all right, Trevor, what were your thoughts?
Suicide Squad was kind of fine. You know, like it wasn't horrible. It wasn't great either. I didn't know we asked for Dark Avengers, but we got it in this book, basically. I agree with what Rocky was saying about that double page spread with like the replicate panels everywhere. It was super cluttered. It drew the eye everywhere, but where it needed to be. And artistically, I normally like Javier Fernandez. I'm a fan of what he did on Nightwing with Tim Seeley. I really did not think that he delivered as, you know, consistent with the rest of DC Future State. Now, if anybody has this book opened, right? So, open to the sixth page in the book, like the sixth interior page. So there's like two spreads. and then interiors. It's when Sinestro is falling. Now, as consistent with a number of the Future State books, there's some serious physical blocking issues. So as Sinestro is falling down, Batman throws some sort of throwing knife, right, to pin him, right, in the shoulder. He's falling down. His back is facing the ground. How did he get pinned to the interior side of the wall that Batman is standing on top of? It doesn't make sense. So he throws it down, and somehow he's magically stuck to the wall. I mean, on the inside, like literally, it's so hard because there's no visuals to show the audience.
I took that to be that's the ground.
It's not the ground. No, because remember they walk up to him.
It's not the ground. Yeah.
They walk up to him in a following.
When I read it originally, I took that to be the ground, but now that I'm looking at the panel.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. Which is like,
wow.
Really, really, really poor physical blocking. And you know, for a veteran, here's the thing. For a lot of these veteran comic book artists that I feel like have been really, frankly, kind of churning out duds in Future State, most of the time they at least keep their sense of camera and their sense of positioning and physical blocking. You know, it's out of instinct. Fernandez throws that out the window there. Like, that was just not blocked out super well at all. And in general, like that scene, Sinestro is probably one of the more powerful DC villains, and he gets taken out like cake. I mean, like, for a character that thrives on fear in that landscape, is everybody not afraid? How is he not feeding off of that? How is he not redonkulously powerful right now, as in general? I don't quite understand that. So it felt a little bit too convenient for the plot for him to be so easily taken out by this C-list, you know, Suicide Squad / Justice League. And then, you know, sort of more on the art before I get more into the writing. There's on the 15th page of the interior, there's a large panel, full shot of sort of the aftermath after Amanda Waller kind of kicks everybody's ass in the meeting room, essentially. We're like 2 meters away from like one of the furthest characters in the shot, and almost none of them have faces. Like, none of them have faces, and they're in like the immediacy of the camera. We're that close, and he's already omitting very sort of basic facial detailing, which I found was rushed, lazy, you know, consistent with Future State art so far. In terms of the writing, you know, I found it pretty okay. Aside from the sort of lazy, like, pedestalizing of this new, you know, group in order to, and sort of, you know, like I said, making other characters look lesser than in order to make them look more fearsome. It happens. I really don't like it. It does bother me, but it's not like it's an uncommon trope. The dialogue was actually really smooth, I found, in this issue, which is uncommon with most of Future State. So, you know, I give Thompson a lot of credit. There was a nice smooth cadence. He imbues a lot of personality in each one of these characters, and they feel individual. And that's something that I think is very important, especially in an ensemble book, because, you know, it's so easy to make every character feel generic, excuse me, or to make everybody sort of sound, you know, like really, really poorly done archetypes. So he was efficient in that way. I think there's like Rocky had said, I think there's a pretty interesting setup, you know, for where we're going with this, and all of the sort of nods to DC history, continuity, and lore being thrown in here. I think it plays well to the fact that we have characters from different reaches in the DC universe. I thought the last page twist was, or not the page before that, because that got spoiled for me, but most everything else was pretty well set up by the end. Good pacing, nice cold open, a couple sort of small questions that I have, like, how did Clayface reconstitute himself so easily? But most of my issues with the writing were, you know, not super major. So overall, I thought it was a pretty okay story. You know, unfortunately, I think Javier Fernandez really sort of fails to deliver in this one. Regarding Black Adam, I did quite like it. you know, it was around the same level as the Suicide Squad story, maybe slightly better, but not by very much. The art was certainly better. You know, I give Passerin a lot of credit. He might not have been what he normally was, I think, on a normal book, but does a pretty good job in this issue. I think the things that I have problems with are how tropey the setup for this Black Adam story can be. It seems really convenient that this threat comes out of nowhere with the capacity to take down the most godly, untouchable force that the DC Omniverse has probably ever encountered in the form of, you know, the Superman Prime, Superman 1 million, aside from the fact that this Justice Legion, I believe they're called, are like exponentially more formidable than any other team of superhero crime fighters we've ever seen. And all of a sudden, you know, this monstrous threat pops up. You know, it's one of those where it very much feels like the writer is bitten off more than they could chew in the two issues, because I'm sorry. Like I'd be hard pressed to see this team take out the normal Justice League, but not this one, not even this one. Sorry. Again, it feels like one of those cheap ways to pedestalize the villain by making other characters look inferior without precedent. There are aspects of the setup that are interesting later on, you know, with, you know, how Black Adam is sort of coerced into reacclimating with his more wrathful nature, literally through the deadly sin of wrath. I thought that was some nice movement with character, because you're able to make this, I don't want to say emotional transition, because I don't think at that point we're very attached to the character, but a very smooth sort of transition into getting him back into where you need him to be for the story. You know, then most of my other sort of issues with the writing become a little bit more sort of silly. You know, Black Adam impregnating a statue. Okay, that's cool. You know, the child gives me the will to live trope, you know, all is lost, but I found out I, you know, knocked my girl up. So now I got to hustle. Okay, cool. Like, you know, I thought there was a solid dialogue and cadence to this book. It doesn't particularly stand out in any way, but it's also like not distinctly good or bad. It just kind of does the job. And I think it's all too easy for these big sort of cosmic stories to get really, really corny in the dialogue. So it was, you know, impressively not bad in that way. And there's an impressive bit of world building surrounding this new planet Kondok. And I actually think that I would have been way more interested to take a deeper dive into the sort of confined into a more confined and personal story of this new Black Adam and his new status quo and the sort of transition from magic to technology and what that means for his character and vice versa. I think that would have been a lot more interesting. You know, regarding Passerin, the design work is nice, solid, clean, maybe not as sharp as what he's normally putting out, but still solid. He has a really good grasp on shot size and positioning, which in a book like this that is in a cosmic setting, I think is actually inherently more difficult to do. So I give him a lot of credit there. And I unfortunately didn't pay attention to who colored this story, but I think the colors do a good job at making these really sort of packed settings that would otherwise come off as very cluttered feel fairly easy to parse through. It was a fine, well-paced story, definitely had its problems, but given the sample size of Future State, it's definitely like the top 50 percentile for sure.
Yeah, Jeremy Cox did the colors. He did all the color work on Hawkman. So I you know, would expect good things from him. So I kind of struggle with this one a little bit, because I would say I'm sort of biased against Amanda Waller. I think she's an absolutely terrible character. I think right from the beginning, she was very tropey, you know, very, very stereotypical, big, angry, you know, heavy set black woman, not going to take any guff, comes from the projects, pulls herself up by her bootstraps, blah, blah, blah. Right. I think I would hope that as storytellers and creators, we've been able to move past that kind of thing. Certainly she's slimmed down over the years, but I still think she's just a terrible character. She's still just that angry black woman. And I think we could do so much better with, you know, showing a female person of color being intelligent and not having to be angry and I don't know. I just think she's a terrible character at this point, and I just want her to go away forever. And as much as it says Suicide Squad on the front cover, this is really Amanda Waller. It's really her story. Maybe you could make an argument for Connor Kent, but Trevor, something he said in when he was talking about is very telling, calling this a C-list Suicide Squad. I mean, let's face it. Most of the time, Suicide Squad's pretty far down the alphabet in terms of what level you would consider the characters. These aren't well-known characters, and now we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel here for whatever reason. So it's clear that this is really an Amanda Waller story, and I can't really think of anything I want to read less than an Amanda Waller story. Like, I cannot stress enough how much I despise this character. So the only time that I ever had anything, any sort of feeling of, okay, that's cool, was when I saw the Crime Syndicate show up, just because I like them as characters. If we're going to get some Crime Syndicate in the second issue, then maybe. But all this reading this did was just make me once again be reminded of how much I despise Amanda Waller and how I want her to go away forever and replace her with somebody who's worth reading about. At this point, she's not even some normal, non-superpowered version of an anti-hero. At this point, she's just a straight-up villain. And it's been that way in every medium, even. You can't tell me whether you like the Suicide Squad movie, the first one, or not. That's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, none of the bad shit would have happened if it wasn't for Amanda Waller. It was her fucking fault that all the stuff happened. Every death is on her. To me, that's just straight up murder. So she's not an anti-hero. She's not someone to look up to. She's just straight up bad, and she needs to go. That's just, I can't stand the character. I don't think there's any redeeming her, and I just want her to disappear forever. I very well may be to the point where I dislike her more than the Joker at this point. Like, that's how much I despise the character. I wish it said Black Adam on the cover, honestly, because I thought that story was way better. Did I have problems with it? Yeah, the art for the most part is great. And I think, like Trevor said, a big part of that has to do with the colors, because they're bright and they're vibrant and they jump right out. The plot story points that I have problems with are things that he talked about, how, here you have the most powerful Superman ever and he can't defeat it, but Black Adam's going to defeat it. And not just Black Adam, by the way. I will point out that, probably not surprisingly, this is a different look for Black Adam than we've ever seen before. Might he in some ways resemble a certain wrestler who may be portraying Black Adam on the big screen come next year? Oh, what a surprise. He's always been very pale with the widow's peak, and now all of a sudden he's got the very, very close cropped hair. His complexion is much darker, much closer to what Dwayne Johnson's is. They make these changes and they think we're not going to notice, whatever. Is it that big of a deal? No. But I just don't feel it's necessary. I don't think the Black Adam in the comic needs to look like what Black Adam's going to look like on the big screen. Because guess what? A lot of those Dwayne Johnson fans, a lot of the fans of The Rock that are going to go see the movie, they're never going to pick up a comic. They're certainly not going to pick up this one that comes out a year, if not further, before the movie comes out. So why are you changing it? Like, why are you changing them? Yeah, the whole impregnating his statue girlfriend kind of thing. What? So there are a few things like that that kind of, make you kind of scratch your head and wonder what the heck's going on. But the big part of the reason that I enjoyed it so much was, I thought the line work was great. I thought the color work was great. But most of all, it was just fun. It was just a lot of fun. You really didn't feel like you were necessarily lost, because there was so much being thrown at you that it felt like it was supposed to be big and boisterous and over the top. It wasn't a situation where through the context of the dialogue or the plot of the story that you felt like, oh wait, am I supposed to know what's going on? No, you knew it was just supposed to be this mile a minute, pedal to the metal sort of popcorn action flick, and you just were along for the ride. So that's what I enjoyed about it most. It was just a whole heck of a lot of fun. And I'll definitely be reading the second part of that. Whether I read the second part of the Suicide Squad, I mean, I probably will, because I'm going to want to talk about it, but I'll certainly flip through it first. Am I going to get some undead Crime Syndicate? Because that would really be the reason that I would want to check it out. And who knows if we'll get that or not. So, yeah, for me, Suicide Squad would be a thumbs down, and the Black Adam story would be a thumbs up. So, all right, well, let's talk about Superman Imperius Lex. This was an interesting story is one way to put it. It's written by Mark Russell. The art is by Steve Pugh. Colors are by Romulo Fajardo Jr. And letters by Carlos Mangual. So what were your thoughts, Rocky? What did you think of this one?
Well, this is very much a Mark Russell comic book. This has Russellisms all through it. Anyone who's ever read Wonder Twins, a single issue, or he did a Sinestro one shot during the DC event last year. It was a DC one shot. Anyways, he's always talking politics. He's got a very unique. A unique way of approaching his writing is very similar. And it's one of those things where if you read a few of his issues a few times, it's good. But then the more you read, the more you realize that it's kind of a one trick pony. Because a lot of the language upon which he writes and the dialogue that he gives the characters here, it's very reminiscent of the dialogue of Wonder Twins and dialogue of his Sinestro that I read. Good stories, they all have some, it's not so much political. I would say it's social. He always addresses social issues and he's very much into the social issues. And I don't mind that. That doesn't take me out of the story. I've even enjoyed it. You know, it's funny when he wrote this in this story, this deals with Lexor, you know, the planet Lexor, which in the Silver Age is Lex Luthor's planet, where Lex Luthor is revered and loved by the people of Lexor. And then in the Silver Age, ultimately Lexor is destroyed and he blames Superman for it. And that it fosters further hatred of Lex Luthor towards Superman. And here he uses it to, he plays on the fact that, and I think it, he does it in a the most effective way possible, I would say, that at least there's a story there with at least a little bit of a less with a moral, I guess, you know, the fact that Lex Luthor is kind of a jerk. I guess you could say he rules Lexor with an iron hand, but he's revered by the people of Lexor. He builds these reticulants, which are basically artificial intelligent robots, which go and pillage and steal from other planets, and other planets hate Lexor. Ultimately, Superman breaks that up, and of course, that leads to a recession on the planet of Lexor, forcing Lex Luthor to apply to the United Planets because they need help. And of course, Lois Lane, who is the leader of representative of Earth for the United Planets, has to bring the application of Lexor before the United Planets because Lexor wants to join. And of course, Superman takes the higher ground here, saying, of course, let's welcome them in. I mean, Superman here, I got, again, this is so, this is such a perfect Superman. It's one of the things that rubbed me a little bit the wrong way. Superman now even thinks that artificial intelligence and robots have life because they're capable of feelings and capable of feeling anger. And it, even the way Superman is, I didn't like the way Superman was drawn here. I don't like this whole regal Superman where he's got this huge gaping S on his chest flowing back into the cape and then the gray hair. And I don't understand the timeline on this either, how this fits in, but that's neither here nor there. Timeline's kind of all over the place. This is a very surface level story. This is very, very surface level. This is a feel good. Superman is perfect. Superman forgives everyone. Even Lex Luthor will invite his enemy to join the United Planets to save the people of Lexor, even though the people of Lexor hate Superman and they blame Superman for their problems, but he's going to go above and beyond and embrace them. And well, again, it's a decent, it's almost a one shot. I don't even need to see how it ends. I will say that the Silver Age story, I come at old school. I remember reading those Silver Age, Lexor planet stories. They were a lot of fun. And I think that I would like to see more of that here. I guess we'll see how it ends. Artistically, again, I wasn't a fan in the way Superman was, Steve Pug. Is it Pew or Pug?
I think it's Pew.
Pew, Steve, yeah. Pew. The art was okay. I mean, it was okay. Romulo Fajardo Jr., I love him as a colorist. He's I've known him for a lot of his work on Wonder Woman over the years. And I thought the color pops off the page. I thought it was okay. It had a, it, it had a decent moral of the story and all that jazz. You know, again, nothing really blew me away, but it was, I appreciated it for, it reminded me of the Silver Age, those Silver Age stories. And yeah, meh.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. You're right about Mark Russell's stories. They always have this social bent, which is fine. And he tries to bring some humor in, which is also fine. And so, but he's not treading any new ground here. And you can kind of see the twist coming a mile away. You know, everybody has that knee jerk reaction. Hey, Lexor as a planet wants to join the United Planets, and we're not going to let him because it's Luthor running it, right? And like Rocky said, Superman comes in and says, well, but you got to realize that this is a planet of people who've been lied to. You know, here we go with another Donald Trump sort of inspired character, you know, Lex Luthor, who, you know, again, we're talking all the way back in the mid-80s when Byrne first shifted Luthor over to being a businessman. That was his inspiration. Little did he know that inspiration would turn out to be a real the closest we've had to a real life supervillain in a long time. But anyway, yeah, you got to remember that a lot of these people on this planet have been duped, and Superman, of course, is going to fight for them. Whether they deserve it or not is, you know, a debate for another day, but Lois does come around to his way of thinking, and that whole idea of her changing her mind and then, you know, being kind of thrown to the wolves when she finds out, oh, well, because you originally brought it up, now you're the one that has to go and work with Luthor to bring them in to the United Planets on a trial basis. Yeah, just very typical Mark Russell. So if you like Mark Russell type stories, if you like the things, the social aspect of his stories and the humor he tries to bring with it, then you're going to like this. And if you don't, then you won't. It's really that simple. I do find it interesting that other than the Batman titles, Dark Detective and the next Batman, this is the only series of Future State that has more than two issues. Imperius Lex gets three issues, whereas everything else only gets two. So what is it about Mark Russell's story that, you know, he had to have three? Will it turn out to be something pretty good? I don't know. Maybe that's why it feels like in this issue, it's not overstuffed like a lot of the other Future State issues do feel. I feel like the plot and the pacing were done really well. And so in terms of not being crowded, whether or not I like the story, I think this one's still up in the air for me. This is one that I'm having a little bit tougher time getting a read on, because Mark Russell stuff, I like it on a case-by-case basis. I can't say that I've liked everything he's done, but some of the stuff that he's done I like a lot, like Flintstones. So we're going to have to wait and see. As far as the art, I'm not a big Steve Pugh fan. For me, his lines are a little heavy, which kind of leads to the transitions feeling a little bit choppy for me. And his Superman, his version of Superman looks a little bit like an old man. And I feel like, man, we're not that far in the future. We've had other Future State books where we're further in the future and Superman looks younger. So again, that's not on Pugh himself necessarily. That's more an editorial thing for continuity purposes. But yeah, I usually generally don't like my Superman to look like an old man. That doesn't really do it for me. So, anyway, what about you, Trevor? What are your thoughts?
You know, I normally really, really like Mark Russell's work, and I often find him to be very nuanced in his delivery of his more sort of political themes. But I found him to be really heavy-handed here, and frankly, pretty awkward in the mixing of his metaphors. Like Rock had mentioned, I believe, about like considering robots like sentient life and how that was supposed to sort of culminate in the ultimate sort of political commentary on like perspectivism and the manipulation of populations and like how you frame that. I thought the robot thing just made Superman come off as naive, which again, it was, I was just kind of tired of having read Batman, Superman already feeling like Superman was naive, especially in this context, because this is a more than veteran Superman. I mean, he's been around the block a few times. You know, he should be, I mean, rather intelligent, rather perceptive. But I found him to be a very sort of simplistic and the way that he handles things. And I didn't hate this issue, but I think that my impression of it was certainly brought down because I know Mark Russell is often a lot smarter about the way in the way that he handles these types of things. And I was actually excited for this book going into it. I've always sort of wanted to see what Mark Russell would do in a sort of Superman, Lex Luthor, you know, political adventure of sorts, but maybe I'm regretting that a little bit. I don't know. I certainly didn't hate this story. I didn't love it either. I also, in a way, echo what Jace was saying about Steve Pugh's art. Is like the only way to describe it. It's kind of okay design wise. I found the gesture work to be very rigid, like super, super rigid. If we're going to spend a lot of time in conversational scenes where you're worrying about gestures, and in action scenes where Superman is getting work done, there should be an articulation in movement to the way that these characters are interacting with other characters and with their surroundings. And that just wasn't here. You know, it was, I didn't hate it. I was certainly a little bit more disappointed because I was hoping Mark Russell would deliver, but you know, all in all, it was maybe just above meh, like just a hair above meh.
All right, Nick.
All right. So I agree with some of you who were saying this definitely felt more measured again, like Batman, Superman, where there lots going on, but doesn't feel rushed. And it absolutely feels like it could be its own story. So I'm actually pretty excited to hear there are two more, because it looks like even Future State, we might be getting more of a classic. And again, this makes Superman look naive a lot, like a classic, like Lex Luthor tricks them, gets Lois Lane with him, blah, blah, blah. Superman has to go fight Lex Luthor at the end again, like he does in this one. Which I don't know, just feels classic and less Future State-y, which I'm hungry for classic comics at the moment. But I thought it was funny in some parts. I kind of like the comedy, like the toy where he's having the toy design and he's like, no, the muscles need to be bigger and the waist should be thinner or something. And even has a line which seems very ironic for Lex Luthor and makes him seem more intelligent. So he's definitely learned in the past, where he talks about how, or at least he's learned from experience, where he's like, you really shouldn't rule by fear. You should rule by like tricking people into your giving them what they want. There's a whole conversation there. Cause like, yeah, it doesn't last if you rule by fear. Like people eventually just aren't scared of you anymore, blah, blah, blah. And I agreed. I was going to ask about Superman, so I'm glad Jace brought it up, where I'm like, well, one of the things I like about this book too, is between Lex Luthor and Lois Lane, you can very much see about when it takes place. I would guess, what, 30 to 35 years after, based on their current appearance?
Yeah.
Whereas Superman looks almost as old as he did in, I did read Wonder Woman, I think, from last week.
Yeah.
And that's the far future, and that Superman looks just as old as this Superman.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask about that, so I'm glad.
Yeah, the Immortal Wonder Woman supposedly takes place when the Earth is about at its end of existence, and he's got a beard and looks super old. And yeah, he looks just as old here. Yeah, one thing I didn't mention about the art was the idea that Luthor's so vain, he's got clearly wearing a mask to try to hide his wrinkles, I guess you'd say,
and faked hands, like a hand model. He's got like those. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, all those little things, the little humor points that you mentioned. Yeah, that's all classic Mark Russell. So again, it goes to my point of saying, if you like Mark Russell books, you're probably going to like this. And if you don't, you won't. And I will kind of echo something that Trevor mentioned. Yeah, I didn't. I've really been anticipating at some point Mark Russell telling a Superman story, because I think it would be interesting. This is not what I was hoping for. Maybe I'd rather have it be in modern times. Maybe he's trying to do too much here or something. I'm not sure, but yeah, it didn't really work for me that much, but I reserve judgment. I'm not going to say, because this one has three issues, I'm hopeful that he can kind of turn it around. All right. Well, let's move on to Dark Detective number two. So this is written by John Ridley. I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up with Next Batman. This is written by Mariko Tamaki, with art by Dan Mora. I think the colors are by Jordi Belair, but I'm trying to find the.
Yep, you got it.
So, yeah, Jordi Belair, and then who's handling the letters?
That I don't know.
Okay, see, this is one thing I dislike about DC, how they can't ever. Oh, there it is. Yeah, Mariko Tamaki writing, Dan Mora on art, Jordi Belair on colors, Aditya Bidikar on
letters. Bidikar.
I would not have guessed that. I've seen her work before, but I would not have guessed that. There's also a Red Hood backup story that when I saw the first page, I was kind of excited because we see the Adrian Chase Vigilante, who's one of my most favorite DC characters ever. But unfortunately, it doesn't last too long because the art is pretty rough. the story itself is written by Joshua Williamson. The art is by Giannis Milano Giannis, who is a Greek artist, colored also by Jordi Belair, letters by Troy Pateri. And yeah, the art is just really, really rough. I think it might've been Trevor. It might've been somebody else I was talking to that basically says the art looks like Doug from Nickelodeon, and that he totally nails it. That's what it looks like. And to me, that is not an art style that you want to be using for the Red Hood. As far as the story itself, it's okay. It's not great. I mean, it's Joshua Williamson. So unfortunately I've not come to expect much from Josh recently. So the premise just doesn't even grab me. The best part about it is the fact that, like I said, Vigilante shows up, but clearly he's not going to be showing back up. And then Rose Wilson shows up, Deathstroke's daughter. And I find her to be an interesting character. And we do learn more about the magistrate. It definitely seems like they are, to Rocky's point earlier, working both sides of the fence. You know, at first Red Hood is working for them and bringing in other people wearing masks. And then maybe when he starts investigating a certain something and gets a little too close to the truth, all of a sudden at the end of the story, he finds out that there's a reward for him now. The magistrate has turned on him. So not a big surprise, but I feel like even though it's Williamson, he didn't even get the story itself didn't get a chance, because I was so put off by the art that I can't even, like, is this a good story? Like, is the idea of the magistrate flipping things around on Red Hood? It seems like that would be kind of interesting. But the art is so bad. It pulls me out of the story at every turn. You want to talk about every face looking the same. There's no difference in the face of Adrian Chase when his mask is pulled off, when he's cuffed and sort of thrown against the desk at the police precinct, and Rose Wilson's face. The only difference is the hair. Otherwise their faces are identical. And these, not only are they two different characters, one is male and one is female. They shouldn't look anything like each other. It's just bad, bad.
At least the character models in Doug had different faces.
Yeah, and they all have like these, they're colored with like this rosy glow on their cheeks. I guess that's supposed to be where Vigilante got hit. I can't even blame Jordi Belair. I don't know how you color this with crayons, I guess. I don't know. It's just, it's so bad. And I'm not saying the guy's a terrible artist. This type of art would work in certain types of stories, but this style is not suited for superhero comics. It's just not. And it's that simple. So that's all I'm going to say about the Red Hood story. It just simply wasn't very good. As far as the Dark Detective goes, yeah, I liked it. I thought the art by Dan Mora was up to his typical quality. He's one of the few artists where I feel like his art hasn't like lost a beat during Future State, and so I've been very, very pleased with that. And again, it goes to show, here's what Jordi Belair can do with appropriate superhero art, because the color work is done for the most part really well. But what I don't understand as far as the color work goes is why, and I gotta assume that this was somebody directing her, to do this because the trade dress on the cover is like this hot pink color. And then throughout the issue, we get a lot of pink, like a lot of pink when Bruce has been shot. And we get the story of how the story of how he died, supposedly. He's basically, it's like this pink wash. He's colored with this pinkish hue all during the fight with Magistrate or Peacekeeper One, rather. And even when he dives in the water of Gotham Bay, what do we see? We see pink. Like, I don't understand what the hell is going on with all the pink. And I don't like it. I don't understand it. It so takes over the story that there's so much of this as the overwhelming color palette that it pulls me out of the story. Because it's this bright, hot pink that isn't realistic. The rest of the story is colored very well. You know, you get a lot of greens and blues and grays that very much suit the kind of dystopian story that Mariko Tamaki is telling here. Were they trying to juxtapose that with all the pink? And that's why, Trevor, when you asked me about the graphic for your in-depth YouTube review of this, which I highly recommend everybody go and check out, link in the description or the show notes. You sent two of them, and one of them had pink in it and one didn't. And I chose the one without the pink because I'm like, man, I've had it with the pink already. Mm. And I'm sure you listeners have had it with me complaining about the pink, but yeah, I just don't get it. But that's really the only problem I had with the story in terms of Bruce kind of establishing a new sort of base of operations with this sort of crazy conspiracy theory guy and him trying to get the lay of the land, him on the Akira looking motorcycle. For the most part, the story worked for me. But just like the first one where I did kind of nitpick on, you know, how is it different? There's been various other times where Bruce supposedly has died and it's managed to come back. I guess we sort of get an answer to that here where, you know, he gets shot, he dies in Gotham Bay. There just so happens to be another dead body, very convenient. And then the magistrate basically wants the citizens of Gotham to feel the absence of Batman, to feel the absence of Bruce Wayne. Hey, Bruce Wayne is dead. I don't think they're actually fooled by it. It's all propaganda. That was just a little like, oh, really? He dives in, there just happens to be a dead body. Are there always, I don't know, maybe there's always dead bodies floating around in Gotham Bay.
So, that's Gotham, of course.
Yeah, it's a Gotham, exactly. Kind of like the East River in New York during the 70s. I thought it was good, above average, not great. And I just don't, man, not to sound like a broken record, I just don't get what the whole, all the pink was about. So anyway, what were your thoughts, Trevor?
Well, I'm going to defend the pink. I'm definitely going to defend the pink. I thought the coloring by Jordy Belair was spectacular. I think the use of that pink tinting first of all, you know, for those of you that don't know, this story has been cross-cutting in the way that it performs its narrative. It goes back to Bruce being hunted down by Peacekeeper One, who is like the head honcho of the Magistrate's Enforcers, and present day, where Bruce is essentially reviving the ghost of Batman for this futuristic Gotham. And the use of pink is a really, really interesting way, I think, in this sort of aesthetic to obviously... I mean, the palette, it makes it more easy to identify where we're shifting in terms of the narrative positioning and in time. But as I've said in the last two Dark Detective reviews, Jordy Belair is very smart in this sort of cyberpunk-esque futuristic Gotham to use a palette consisting primarily of CMYK colors, which are cyan, yellow, magenta, and black, which are the base colors that printers naturally use to blend to make other colors, believe it or not. So they don't use like red, green, blue, like your computer would and light sources. It uses those, all of those sort of transitional colors and blends those to make the standard colors in a printer. So they come out more naturally, more saturated on the page. And I actually think that sharp contrast between those colors really works for this neon, glowy, you know, afterlight sort of Gotham. And I think the pink, again, is a really nice way to help, you know, a reader who might not be able to pick up on context clues as well to identify that we're setting some part of this narrative in the past and some part in the future. And I think it's just because it's a hot color that it becomes a lot more obvious, because if you notice a lot of futuristic scenes where Bruce is sort of wandering about, you know, they're using these very sort of cool blues and things like that. So there are cinematic color consistencies throughout this book. I just think that the pink is just a sharp color that tends to stand out more. But in terms of the overall sort of work, I mean, Dan Mora is a monster. He's so good. And it is really refreshing to talk this positively about an artist in Future State. He's so freaking good that it's hard for me to actually intellectualize it, I think, in many ways. You know, he's unmatched in character acting. I've talked about a lot of really rigid character acting and lack of fluidity throughout this week and pretty much every other week we've been doing these Future State Fridays. And Dan Mora is killer. And not only is he able to make them feel articulate in the way they move and the way they express, the camera work is dumb good. He knows when to get intrusive. He knows when to pull back. There's a moment where when you get the first flashback to the past, you have a scene where Bruce gets sort of tagged by Peacekeeper One, and he turns around and fires his grapnel gun at point blank range at the Peacekeeper. And there's so much nuance in the way that he composes that shot, how he's putting the camera just in this like three quarter view behind Peacekeeper as he's getting shot, and we're slightly lifted up. It's so brilliantly done, seriously. And Dan Mora is one of those few artists who's been able to sort of break panel borders multiple times on single pages and have it not be cluttered, to have it still feel dynamic and fresh. He's just so instinctive in his visual storytelling, and that combined with the fact that I really do like his design aesthetic makes me really enamored with his art. And I think Jordi Belair did a spectacular job finishing this off with colors. You know, she not only aces that neon aesthetic that I brought up earlier, but she knows when to pull back for sort more of like intimate scenes, more scenes to sort of convey Bruce's loneliness and the sense of setting. You know, from the quiet, fast paced stuff, with introspection, between like the camera, light sourcing, establishment of the sequential narrative, Dan Mora is killer. I really can't say enough about how good Dan Mora is. And I can't wait to see him do more Batman stuff. I've been asking for it for years, so I'm so glad to have gotten it. Regarding Tamaki, I think one of the ways she actually does slightly better than the last issue is with plot. Because the first issue wasn't plot heavy, almost. Like it really didn't have any plot at all. It was a lot more thematically, you know, woven, which I liked. I think that's a fine way to weave a first issue. And in fact, to be frank, that's what I did for the first issue of my comic. It's not plot heavy at all. It's more thematically sort of setting you up for what's to come, so that by the time you get to plot, it's more impactful. And I think that's a pretty effective way, if I do say so myself, of setting up a first issue. Unlike most of Future State, there's a smooth delivery of expository information throughout sort of contextual things in art, character dialogue, character internal monologue, which is nice. It's well balanced. I don't feel like we're being thrown a bunch of information sort of heedlessly. But on that, I did feel like the sort of internal monologuing began to take on more of a conversational tone that I thought was a little bit, I don't want to say too boisterous, but it's boisterous for Bruce Wayne in some ways. And it begins to get a little bit too bouncy. And that's just a personal thing. That's just not, to me, you know, Bruce Wayne in my head are very sort of sharp, poignant sentences, because he's not a talker. He just likes to get to the point. Overall, I still think that, you know, the way she handles monologuing and such did a greater net good, you know, than anything else. We do get some really nice sort of metaphorical presence through Bruce Wayne's monologue and an identification of where he's standing emotionally and mentally in this story. I agree with Jace regarding plot, the sort of convenience of a corpse that vaguely looks like Bruce Wayne and is vaguely dressed like Bruce Wayne in the exact right place at the exact right time. Yeah, that was like a glaring mishap in this story for me. I mean, luckily Tamaki is able to sort of bring herself in and tell a fairly tight story that is thematically driven and also carries a good amount of plot at a breakneck pace, at a good entertaining yet cinematic pace. So, you know, I do tend to forgive that, but it wasn't like I didn't notice. All in all, it was a good issue. And you know, like Jay said, if you want a more sort of analytical breakdown, feel free to go check out my review of the first two issues of Dark Detective. So you can get a little bit more of an articulate idea of how I feel about it. Regarding Red Hood, I mean, yeah, I did say to Jace last we spoke that the art is just, it's not, you know, superhero comics worthy. It does very much look like a pared down version of the Doug character designs from the old, you know, Nickelodeon.
What one positive I'll say about this art in the Red Hood story, it makes the Mr. Miracle art that we saw in Superman One and Superman Worlds of War look that much better. It really does.
Yeah, it's really tough, man. I think because I wrote like a little bit of notes, and I don't know. I am a little bit remiss to say exactly what I wrote, because you know everybody was just kind of bagging on pundits who are rather critical on books, who like, that's just inherently what I am. So I guess I shouldn't be so unabashed about it, but I have enough respect not to go so far on a platform that is not mine. So I will say it wasn't well handled. The character design work was really sort of feeble, along with the backgrounds. I mean, there is an early page in the story where you get this big establishing shot of the city, and it looks like my 3-year-old nephew drew it. It was pitiful, like wonky lines, no rendering, left all the work to the colors. I mean, boy, was it not well set up. You know, I understand when you need to pull back from background detail for time constraints or just because of distance and shot, but when your entire shot is an establishing shot that is trying to give you a sense of the size of the city, and your background looks like it's drawn by a 3-year-old, that's a big problem. That is a big, big problem. You know, to kind of break up the criticisms, what the artist does with camera isn't bad. It's just unfortunate that everything on camera is really lackluster and subpar. Like, there's a nice transition where, you know, he slams Vigilante's head down, or Vigilante is about to slam down from getting sort of taken off of his motorcycle. And the next page transition, his head is getting slammed into the desk. You know, that's a nice, I think, sort of little narrative transition there with the camera. But other than that, there's really not much, there's not anything else to compliment the art on. And as somebody who has established that they have vehemently disliked everything that Josh Williamson has done in the last 3 years, I didn't hate the story. Now, it wasn't good. It wasn't good. And I won't even give him that much. But I didn't hate it. It was, yeah, rather vanilla. Yeah, kind of tropey. Yeah, the Vigilante gets turned on by the system that like is employing him, and he inherently identifies the hypocrisy. Yeah, we've seen that before. It's not like, it's not unique or original. But, you know, it was fairly well-paced. You know, I'll give him that. He told a well-paced story with a mildly engaging, albeit unoriginal plot. I will say there were times where he gets really hammy in tone, which Williamson has just been known to do these last couple years, especially in that bar scene. You're like, oh, this is a moment to get a little bit of badass, angry, disheveled Jason Todd. And he kind of gets, you know, the guys behind him is like, well, you know, Bozo, what are you doing in this neck of the woods? And, you know, it's, you know, I just did want to make a point that as somebody who has been a critic of Joshua Williamson these last couple of years, that he actually wasn't the biggest downfall of a story for once. So that was refreshing, albeit not a wonderful context to be in. But yeah. Dark Detective story was great. So if you buy this book, at least, you know, consider buying it for that.
What are your thoughts, Nick?
I like the Dark Detective story a lot. Because I didn't read New Batman yet from last week, this is the first story that I've gotten the second part of the four-parters. So, of course, it feels like a normal comic, complete arc, even with the part of it used for backup story, which I don't really have much of an opinion on. I do have a major complaint with one line in it. Maybe I'm just crazy, but it sounds like a Deadpool or Spider-Man pun, not something Batman would say, where he says cybers with voices that sound like a robotic game show host. And I'm like, am I wrong? That doesn't sound anything like Batman Bruce Wayne to me.
Yeah,
that sounds punny.
That was definitely one of those moments where I thought Bruce was getting a little bit too like jumpy and conversational. I didn't think it was like, because I mean, we've seen some Spider-Man Deadpool ham. So I don't know if I'd go that far, but I definitely get what you're saying.
Yeah, it felt like the weirdest thing I've heard Batman say in any medium since Batman and Robin, like George Clooney Batman. I was just like, that just doesn't sound like something Batman would say in his own head. Like, I don't know. But otherwise, yeah, it's a great, like, it would work great as a non-future state. Just like, oh, Batman's on the run. I love that he's penniless. You know, like that whatever went wrong is, you know, he's not just dead. He doesn't have any money. So like, so he's staying in a guy's basement. What did he do? Fix his TV to get a motorcycle and stuff like that. Just comical. And I do like the joke he makes about like, he hasn't broken the TV yet because he has to get spying on him. That one does feel like a Batman joke that fits that thing. And then at the end, he destroys it, the old man. So it was a fun, I enjoyed it as a Batman story. I will say, as far as the Red Hood story, it's standing out to me, I think, just because Future State's doing future versions of all characters, but it is a part of both DC and Marvel tradition. But just like, you know, seeing the daughter wearing Deathstroke's outfit, it's like, it's just weird. I don't know. It feels weird now that we're getting it in every book where it's like, yeah, of course there's a follow-up Wonder Woman and a follow-up Deathstroke and a follow-up, like, now a new Aquaman. And maybe that's weird. And that happens in Aquaman a lot, too, is what I really thought about it. Because maybe it stands out to me weird because I mostly watch the movies and in there they've never called Wonder Woman once, I think, in the three movies she's in or four. Like, not even, like, you know, in the comics, they'll be out of fight and, like, Bruce will say Wonder Woman instead of Diana. But even when they're talking to each other as part of the Justice League, they're never like, Batman or Wonder Old Batman, yeah, because Batman and Superman are even brands within the MCU. But I don't know. Just all these aliases. I know it's done all the time, but when you're seeing like every book, every week featuring like the new version of Batman's always made sense with the Robins, like the new version of Aquaman, the new Wonder Woman. It's like, God, these like, yeah, it just doesn't matter who they are. They just continue on forever. But yeah.
What are your thoughts, Rocky?
Well, first I'd say that on the pink topic, the pink is a color that I just, as you guys were talking, I had, and listening to your insights, when I reviewed the first issue of Dark Detective, the color pink is clearly associated with the past, with showing the past. And so I think that was an intentional choice just to maybe help the reader distinguish between the past and the present. And so for that reason, I think, Jace, maybe you'll be more forgiving if you read it all in as one story, perhaps. I actually didn't mind the pink myself. I thought it sort of popped off the page. And I also say this, I think Marika Tamaki, I wish she would have written this well on Wonder Woman, but she did not. This is probably her best written work to date, in my opinion. I will say this as a potential criticism of the story that is saved by the art. There's at least there's 6 to 8 pages of this that are completely wasted in terms of a narrative. It's wasted pages because it's information that we actually found out in the first chapter of this story in week one. And here we are being repeated the same information. The benefit we get is that we get Dan Mora's beautiful art as we get another flashback. So it's that trade-off there, which is fine because, you know, frankly, it does have a little bit of a cinematic feel to it. The colors really pop off the page. I say that as an underhanded compliment, frankly, because I it's hard to say anything negative about the Stark detective story. It's just entertaining. I thoroughly enjoyed Bruce, the detective side of Bruce Wayne here, living in a basement suite, trying to figure out who on earth would know that killing Bruce Wayne is killing Batman, figuring out the linkages between the magistrate, Mayor Nakano, the Wayne tech that led to the development of those micro drones that are spying on the people of Gotham, and that maybe the crazy guy he lives with in the basement suite isn't so crazy after all. This is actually a well-paced story. It had humor. It had fun. It felt there was an adrenaline rush. The pacing, the transitions from the past to the present, I thought worked very well. Ironically enough, I think because of the different color palettes that you guys have both addressed, and so that's impressive. With respect to the Red Hood story, you guys spoke about the art. I won't comment on that. I will say though that I did. Just from a storytelling point of view, I never really got a handle. I don't know if Joshua Williamson has a handle on Red Hood. I this never felt like Red Hood to me. Unless Red Hood is he undercover? I find it very hard to believe that Jason Todd would work for the magistrate, and then just very casually, you know, apprehend a guy, and then along comes Rose and cuts him in half, and he's so nonchalant about it, and then turn around and then express sympathy that the guy was only, you know, that he was just an ordinary nobody, you know, doing this for the betterment of other people of Gotham. It just never felt Jason Todd, like, is he good? Is he bad? How does he really feel? He seemed to be all over the place. What does he stand for? Why is he even in Gotham? Why doesn't he leave? I never felt that Joshua Williamson gave us enough information about what's going on in Red Hood's head. Is he actually working undercover? Is he not leaving Gotham because he thinks Bruce Wayne is still alive and that's why he's not leaving? But if he's not leaving, then why is he? I just don't like. He seemed too much of a pawn to me, and it something didn't quite feel right about it. You guys never really talked about Jason Todd's characterization, but I thought maybe it was a little off to me, but maybe you guys will feel different. But I am curious to see how it ends.
Yeah, the art pulled me out of the story so much, I didn't necessarily notice. Now that you kind of call it to my attention, yeah, you're probably right. That probably is a failing of Joshua Winston. As far as the pink being the flashback, I totally get that. I just felt like, it didn't pull me out of the story in the first issue, but the overabundance of that color in the second issue, it did pull me out of the story. I noticed it. So I just think even if that's what they're doing, I totally get that. But I think you got to be a little more judicious in it, because you don't want to ruin the flow of the story. Do you have something you're going to add, Trevor?
I was just going to say, I think the most consistent thing about Jason Todd for DC is that his character has been super inconsistent these last couple of years. So, I don't think that's why I just wasn't super taken aback by it, because it's every chance they get, Jason Todd is just like this angsty, you know, ill-adjusted, you know, character and you know, obviously done to degrees of diminishing returns. And regarding colors, I was just thinking to myself, man, are you gonna have like war flashbacks if like the next shirt on the Kickstarter has like a hot pink logo?
Oh, please don't do that.
Because I'm not gonna lie, I've considered it.
Don't do that. All right, let's move on to the last book. It's Future State Aquaman number one, written by Brandon Thomas, art is by Daniel Sampier, colors by Adriana Lucas, letters by Clayton Cowles. Nick, what do you think?
This will be easy, quick and short. I will preface this by saying that the only Aquaman comic I think I've ever read was issue one of New 52. I didn't even see the Aquaman movie, which is the only DCEU movie I haven't seen, just because I don't have much love for the character. The whole water setting and such. I did find that the new Aquaman and the new Aquawoman had good chemistry when they were like stuck together and, you know, journeying through different dimensions, as far as I could tell. It was cool to hear her powers literally in comparison to her dad's, literally controlling the fish and the sea life, not talking to them. That was kind of a cool idea. But just going back to the only other Aquaman I've ever read, issue one, it did do one of my favorite things for Aquaman, where this is the only reason I remember that book. It opens with, you know, a bank robbery or something, and then Aquaman shows up in the middle of the city. You're like, what are you doing here, Aquaman? Don't you only do water crimes? And then there's the part later where he's eating fish and chips, and they're like, oh, look, Aquaman's eating fish, which does a lot for the character. It actually reminds me of a line from Age of Ultron, which I feel more movies need because it makes it all work. Or Hawkeye, especially all these teams have superheroes and unsuperpowered, whether it's Suicide Squad, Justice League, Avengers, where Hawkeye says, like, we're on a floating city, we're fighting robots, and all I got's a bow and arrow. It's like, doesn't this make sense? This is where we're at. So that's always kind of been my philosophy on Aquaman in that comic. But yeah, that's about all I have to say about this, because I read it all, but
yeah,
it's fine. It's just one of my least favorite characters, not for me.
All right, what about you, Rocky?
It is, again, an evolution of the original. Yeah, again, we're getting into Aquaman 2 or new Aquaman and all that stuff.
What about you, Rocky? What are your thoughts?
I really enjoyed this. This was just another Future State comic that put a smile on my face. I love Andy. I love the color palette here. I love the ocean, the different colors of the ocean. I mean, the colorist here being Adriano Lucas did a really good job.
He did Freedom Fighters, and ever since his work on Freedom Fighters, I have been a huge fan of his. He is amazing.
Yeah, well, he's very good here. I really enjoyed this issue. I will say, from a timeline point of view, I think there's some inconsistencies about Andy's age, because I think when she's swimming with Jackson Hyde, she can't be, I think that's got to be 20, 30. She can't be more than 13 or 14 years old. She looks a little older than that. And yet when she's, and then when he's prisoner from being held, when Jackson Hyde is later held prisoner by the Neptunians, that has to be around 2040, I think. And so I'm guessing. So I'm a little bit unclear as to the timeline, but it didn't take me out of the story. I really quite enjoyed it. The whole idea of the confluence, this ocean of different time and space, I really liked that idea. And I thought this was pretty cool. And I love how the issue starts off with Jackson Hyde sort of trying to escape and being pulled off, and he's pulled into the deep and the depths by the Neptunians. And then it shows him, he sees something that gives him hope. And it's later revealed, of course, that what he sees is a message in the water that says Aqua Woman lives. And it's just, I thought it was very well done. And the way the story was structured and paced, it really built up the suspense. And I love the conversation he was having with the Neptunian king, and how arrogant the Neptunian was, almost like a benevolent king saying, you know, you're a prisoner. Why don't you understand? We treat you well. Why do you act this way? And of course, it's showing that flashback with him and Andy and the guilt that Jackson Hyde feels, because he said he would always promise to protect her. And of course, he lost her at some point in the confluence. And I'm imagining there's an undisclosed period of time where you got to wonder, you know, where did Andy end up? Where did Aqua Girl, Aqua Woman end up? And then, wherever she ended up, we know where she is now at the end of this issue. And it really worked for me. Kudos to Brandon Thomas as a writer. I'm really impressed. I look forward to more of his writing. This really pulled me in. It got my attention. It hit all the high notes. Daniel Sampier, the art was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I love that scene where Andy, has to remove one of her own limbs just to save Jackson Hyde. It's kick-ass. The colors are beautiful. I got to give this is my highest grade of the week. I quite enjoyed this.
All right, Trevor, what are your thoughts? So Rocky and I read this first, both really liked it, and we were telling Trevor how great it was. So he saved it for last. And then after I had asked you if you had read it yet, you're like, no, I'm saving it for last. Then I thought, man, I hope Rocky and I didn't build it up too much, and then it ended up disappointing you. I was like, I got to be careful about that next time. Anyway, what did you think?
Yeah, this was bangers good. This was really good. You guys actually, I was actually afraid of that too, to be 100% honest, because I remember last week Rock was speaking very, very highly of Suicide Squad, and I read it. I was like, oh shit, no, don't do this to me. This was really good. I think this is 100% a contender for the best book of Future State. First of all, remember that time I said we need young, hungry writers that actually know the medium? Ding, fucking ding, DC Comics. This is it. This is the only young writer that is 2 for 2 on his Future State stories between this and his Outsiders backup in the next Batman. Although this is, I think, definitely better. First of all, just from the jump, great cold open. Awesome cold open. Great way to grab your attention. This really dynamic, depthful art by Sampere with brilliant colors. The characters feel so lively and so full of personality between, you know, looking at Jackson individually and the journey that he's going on. And like Nick had mentioned, the chemistry between these two characters was so well done. It is so refreshing to see identifiable, interesting, relatable characters that have a cadence in the way they sound, that have a just an overwhelming personality. And that is also very indicative of the great collaborative nature between what Brandon Thomas and Daniel Sampere are doing in this story, because they play off of each other so, so well. At times, actually quite frequently, he uses dialogue and internal monologue for exposition, mostly dialogue, and he does it in bulk. But I give Brandon Thomas a lot of credit, because he still finds a way to weave it into the natural cadence of the characters. Every other time somebody's info dumped, and Brandon Thomas does relatively info dump here, every other time it has come off as overwhelmingly clunky, like a total stopgap in the story that takes me out. He does a good job at sort of sequestering all of these beats out in terms of expository information throughout the course of the issue, and again weaving it into the character's natural cadence. So I give him a lot of credit. So he literally takes that the sort of excuse we were making in week one for these writers about not having enough time, and saying, hey, you know, it's almost like you could just not bite off more than you could chew. It's almost like you can just tell a story that works within the time that you have. Because while this story isn't super complicated and it's not super crazy, it's really good. It's really well done. I really like Rocky had mentioned, the sort of world building that's happening with this idea of the confluence. And given the fact that DC's sort of omniversal, you know, platform for the coming publishing line is going to be a thing, I really, really hope that we see more of the confluence and how that's going to play out as a larger sort of schematic piece. You know, the story was paced really well, very brisk, easy to run through. He very much knew, again, how much time he had for the story, and he didn't complicate the plot, the narrative, or the theme. And he's able to roll it out, make this feel emotional. And in this one issue, I'm attached. And mind you, I haven't caught up with Kelly Sue DeConnick's Aquaman run. I read the first issue and for whatever reason, you know, didn't end up following up as much as I'd like to have. But you know, I feel attached to Andy Curry in this one issue. I feel attached to Jackson Hyde. I feel like they're very likable. They're very engaging. And I give him a lot of credit for putting in that much work in a single issue. Again, Semper's art is super cinematic, with an equally instinctive, you know, ability to set up his shots throughout the story with a solid layouts. Colors, again, what was the color's name again?
It's Adriana Lucas.
Adriana Lucas really knocks it out with these really full, saturated, contrasting colors. And they do it without being super overbearing, which I think is a really, really hard balance to strike. And I give them a lot of credit here. And knowing that, knowing the work that they did over Eddie Barrows' work now in Freedom Fighters, and seeing what they're doing here, they're two totally different methods of coloring, which just speaks volumes about the versatility of this person as a color artist, which is now, you know, 100% put them in my scope. Like I will definitely be keeping an eye out for them and their work, because, you know, that is a profound jump in style that they're able to carry through and in tone. So this was a great issue. This was really solid. If you buy any book throughout Future State and you want something digestible and solid from cover to cover, this is the one I recommend.
I just want to add one thing. I love that they avoided the trope. I said this in my review on my channel. I love that I was expecting the Aquawoman to show up on the final page. And I love that they avoided that. He avoided that temptation because it ends and Aquawoman still hasn't appeared. And to me, this felt like an Aquawoman comic, not an Aquaman comic. And of course, Jackson Hyde is the future Aquaman, but this felt like an Aquawoman comic to me. And that's a high compliment to Brandon, the writer. Incredible, because I mean, the fact that she never made a final page appearance and they had that trope of the hero showing up on the final page, I'm so desperate to see to buy this next issue. I mean, he really, really has really managed to get me excited for the next issue. Highest compliments.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying here. I mean, as far as, is it the best Future State issue for me? I mean, you know, I got to put some consideration for Legion of Superheroes, but maybe not, but no, I mean, the fact of the matter is for me up to this point, it's not close. This is by far my favorite issue. And I'll echo what Trevor said about the colors from Lucas. I mean, we have some beautiful blues in the ocean and then they dive, you know, Jackson Hyde and Andy dive under the water. Now it's a green palette. And it's done beautifully well. And just to, you know, mention the work he did on Freedom Fighters with Eddie Barrows, there was always at least one or two big explosions or big action scenes where he got to showcase using color to imitate light. And the colors mm-hmm. would literally come off the page. This two-dimensional image sitting in front of me on a screen or on paper would look like it was actually a source of illumination. That's where his color shone for me in Freedom Fighters. Here he's doing it more traditionally with the actual tones that he's, you know, color tones that he's choosing and how he brings the line work to art. So yeah, two totally different ways of showcasing what color can bring to a comic, and he does it expertly. Both Nick and Trevor mentioned the relationship between Andy and Jackson, which I find to be very compelling as well. It's that whole older brother looking out for his younger sister kind of thing. But what Brandon Thomas does here that's so interesting, here we have Andy, the daughter of Mira and Aquaman, two very regal, noble heroes in the DC universe with a long history in terms of publishing history. But she's very much the heir to this heroism. And you have to imagine that the formative time she did have with them, they very much impressed on her responsibility as not only a hero, but also responsibility to, you know, Atlantis, even though at the end of Kelly Sue DeConnick's run, they abdicated the monarchy and were trying to bring a democracy to Atlantis. There's still going to be that legacy feel of her being the, you know, the quote unquote princess of Atlantis. That's the way the citizens are going to see her, at least for a few generations. So you juxtapose that with Jackson Hyde, who is trying in some way to make up for his own legacy. He's the son of Black Manta, right? Like the most well-known Aquaman villain there is. And he doesn't understand why his dad is a villain. It pains him that his dad has done all these terrible things. And he's trying to turn over a new leaf. And he's the one mentoring the heir apparent to Arthur Curry and Mira. So I love that that's the extra layer. It's kind of the subtext underneath their relationship. You know, who is the hero? Who is not? There's the whole scene with Andy where we find out that, yeah, her dad could communicate with fish. She's controlling them. She doesn't feel like that's right. So there's all these little character moments that even though this is a pretty fast-paced issue and there's a lot packed in here, that we still have time for those character moments. And then, of course, the end when Jackson Hyde is still a prisoner of the Neptunians, but he realizes that what he's been trapped by is his own lack of self-confidence, which, again, it harkens back to how he doesn't feel worthy because of who his father is. And it was such a powerful moment when he realizes through a lot of the emotion and mentorship and love for Andy is the kind of the background motivation of how he's able to rise above and realize, hey, I do have worth. I do have something to offer. I am a badass. And he kind of breaks free and the Neptunians are like, holy crap. And it's such a great scene. The art and the emotion in his face as he comes to that realization, the line work by Daniel Sampieri, the facial expression, all of it is done expertly well. And all I can hope, DC Comics, you have not announced an ongoing Aquaman comic for Infinite Frontier. Please, for the love of God, Brandon Thomas needs to be the writer writing this comic. Please
retweet.
Like, retweet. Oh my God, yep. you have to put this man on an Aquaman comic. Like, you have to. Please don't throw some, you know, Tim Sheridan or some, you know, random person you pull in off the street. This man has shown he understands these characters. He can bring a depth to it. Maybe it's an Arthur Curry and Jackson Hyde story. I'm all in for that. You know, and Andy's kind of along for the ride. Maybe it's more of an ensemble and you get Mira involved too, Black Manta. You know, there's any number of ways you can go, but Brandon Thomas deserves to have a monthly book. And I really think it should be Aquaman because he clearly has invested in these characters and that corner of the DC universe. I think a lot of people like Nick even said, it's the one DC movie that he hasn't seen is Aquaman. But if you can tell good stories, people will come. When Jeff Johns, you know, he has a loyal following. When he was on Aquaman, when New 52 started, it was actually in the top half of the New 52 books in terms of sales numbers. It can sell. And this was such a great, great issue. Far and away my favorite. And I really hope if you haven't checked it out, please do so. Check it out. Make sure you throw it out there on social media. Hey, DC Comics, Brandon Thomas, ongoing Aquaman. It's really what we need. So that's it. I think that overall, this may have been the best week for me, dragged down a little bit by obviously the Legion of Superheroes. But other than that, I didn't feel any of the comics were, you know, like probably maybe slightly above average for Batman, Superman, and Lex, the Imperius Lex story. For me, the Black Adam story and Suicide Squad really elevated that one. And I know I'm biased for the Suicide Squad story. I have a hard time seeing that one objectively. But I thought that Dark Detective was really good. I thought Aquaman was, you know, a standout. So I'm going to give this a 6.5 for the week, which is at least as high, if not my highest score that I've given so far. What about you, Rocky? What are you going to score this week?
I actually had to add it up, and I'm actually taking out Legion of Superheroes. If I include Legion of Superheroes, it's a 6.67. But if I take it out and I just extrapolate the other one, it's a 7.2. It's my second favorite week of Future State, but that's still a high compliment. I'm still loving Catwoman and Nightwing. Last week was just really good. Them together, just they tweaked out overall. I think this week, although again, I guess I. Legion of Superheroes is such an outlier that if I feel bad including it here, because it takes away from the goodness of Aquaman.
Yeah. What about you, Nick?
I think this is by far the highest score I've given it on the other 2 weeks out here. I'm gonna give it a 7.
Wow.
I just enjoyed most of them. Most of them were not Legion, which I give the complaint. Most of the comics I haven't liked in Future State are the ones that feel like we're fitting two acts into the first issue.
Right.
And I felt all these comics felt much more, most of these comics felt much more balanced and pacing and stuff. So it was a much more enjoyable read than some of the other first weeks of the titles.
What about you, Trevor?
Well, I had the supreme fortune of not reading the gutter trash that was Legion of Superheroes. Thank God. Bless my taste buds. In which case, this is definitely the best, the most consistent, like, week of Future State. We'll put it out there. I did not read Legion of Shit Heroes. And with that, you know, I think the lowest story on the totem pole here was maybe like a 5. So that's like not terribly bad for Future State. And, you know, Aquaman was, I think I could consider it the best book of Future State. I would have to really sit back and think, but it's up there, man. Like, Aquaman is probably somewhere above a 9. Dark Detective is a solid 8.25 or so. So those are by far, like, this week has had the two sort of the highest like a two that I've ever had in a single week. While not the lowest lows, and again, acknowledging that I didn't do Legion, maybe a 6.75. I might go as far as saying seven. And with that caveat, I'm retroactively changing last week's from, like, I think I said 5.5. I'm bringing that down to a five because this was just reminds me of, like, the fact that you could have done much better. So that's a five. I'd say this is somewhere roughly between a 6.5 and a seven. It was a solid week. And I'm clearly my attitude is all the better for not reading Bendis. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I agree. And I think it's clear, everybody, if you listen to our episode last week, that Nightwing and Catwoman had been the best two stories so far. And I feel Aquaman surpasses those two. And I feel like part of the reason it does is because it's not caught up in the magistrate stuff. It's not caught up in any of the other kind of just overall plot of Future State, which they're not supposed to tie together anyway, but they're sort of stuck in that world. And you still have to sort of, you know, try to navigate and figure out, okay, what's going on? Mm. Aquaman, it stands alone all on its own. You literally don't have to read anything else. And it's just, I don't know. I thought it was for me a better read than those other two. So,
you know what I was just going to say real quick, you know, what does kind of sting though, is that I feel like the magistrate setup is a pretty good one. Like, I feel like it's a really fruitful environment to tell stories, especially with a cast that is primarily street level heroes. So it's kind of a shame that there is this sort of inconsistency. And it is a shame, I think, that, you know, you kind of making a habit or making a point of saying that one of the things that makes Aquaman so good is that it didn't have that setup, is because I think that it could have been really good across the board, but the consistency in creativity, both in writing and art, is just not been there.
Yeah. Well, that's the danger of DC going forward that I worry about, where they're saying that they're going to be continuity light, because when you do have different creators telling a story in the same kind of setting, and they are, you run the risk of having that inconsistency when you don't have everybody in the same room kind of pulling in the same direction. Just because you're all pulling in the same direction and you're all editorially taking the same cues doesn't mean you still don't have freedom to have your characters, you know, go through their own journey. So it that is the one thing I worry about with DC saying, well, it's the omniverse, just put it wherever. Well, you still want consistency of tone, especially if you're talking about a family of books. And clearly the magistrate, that's all the Batman family, you know, whether it's Red Hood or Tim Drake Robin or Bruce Wayne Batman or Jace Fox Batman, you know, whoever it is, you want some consistency there. So anyway, that's going to do it, everybody. As always, want to thank you all for listening. Be sure you go and check out these guys' channels. There's links in the show notes below where you can go and find them online, social media, YouTube channels for both Rocky and Trevor. So be sure you join us next week. We'll be back with week five, which should be interesting, as we're starting to get the conclusions to some of these stories. So be sure you join us then, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.